WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in the age of modern terrorism, the one thing you may think you know about the Middle East, it's all about the Shiites versus the Sunnis. Saudi Arabia is Sunni, Iran is Shiite, they're competitors. ISIS is Sunni, the Iraqi government, which it attacks, is Shiite, and on out from there. But my next guests say don't believe the conventional wisdom. It isn't just about ancient religious disputes. It has a lot to do with Western dominance during the Cold War and the Iraq War. And we should understand that if we want to protect ourselves for the future, as well as the people of the Middle East themselves, we have to have a more deep understanding. Nader Hashemi is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. Danny Postel is assistant director of the Middle East and North African Studies program at Northwestern University. Together, they are editors of a new book, Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Professors, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Brian.
So I'll ask the questions. You guys can decide who to answer or who will answer. You start the book by laying out a map of the Islamic world. So for our listeners who really don't know, by and large, how much is Shiite in the world and how much is Sunni? Can you go over some of the basics?
Is Nader sure. on the line?
Yeah, I'm on the line.
Go ahead.
Basically, it's about 85% Sunni, which is the dominant sort of mainstream interpretation of Islam, and about 15% Shia. And there's several countries in the Middle East that are Shia-majority societies, Iran, Iraq, Bahrain in particular stand out. And then there's sizable Shia presences and populations in countries such as Lebanon and Pakistan. And Azerbaijan also is majority Shia, but that really doesn't factor into the debate because it's considered to be part of the former Soviet Union and not really part of the Middle East.
And you locate the rise of modern Islamist politics to the 1960s and 70s, the Cold War era, really, when about the only kind of dissent allowed in some important countries was religion-based. Can you describe that era and the role of politicized Islam?
I can say just a little bit about that, that, you know, it's often forgotten these days because, as you said in your introduction, Brian, the new conventional wisdom is all about sectarianism and ancient religious hatreds and supposedly permanent trans-historical antagonisms between different sects of Islam. But the reality is that you don't have to go too far back in history to, as you say, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s to find an era in which there were all sorts of social movements in the Middle East that didn't revolve around religion but revolved around different kinds of issues like class, like labor. There were huge working class and trade union movements across the region. There were all sorts of civic associations and various kinds of cross-cutting connections between people of different religious identities in the region. Various governments in the Middle East systematically crushed a lot of these movements, particularly the movements with a more left-wing militant agenda, of which there were quite a few. It's often forgotten. And this, of course, gave rise to, as you alluded to, more religious-based movements, which were tolerated at that time and benefited from the crushing of these left-wing, class-based, and other sorts of political associations.
The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt being a prime example, which helps to explain why that's who was left to fight the government. And, well, that's who was able to really win in the short outbreak of democracy after the Arab Spring, right?
Yeah, that's definitely a big factor. Now, to be sure, the Muslim Brotherhood also experienced repression and the jailing of many of its leaders during the period of Arab nationalism under Nasser in Egypt, as did the Muslim Brotherhood chapters in various other countries. But they were allowed to continue. They were allowed to exist. They were allowed to function. Eventually, in Egypt, of course, they were allowed to run candidates for parliament and eventually develop into such a mass-based movement that they were well-positioned to succeed in the post-Mubarak period when democratic elections were introduced for the first time in Egyptian history.
And you also cite the failure of nation-building over a century of time as a contributor to the region breaking down along sectarian lines. Nation-building is a dirty word now in American politics with respect to the Middle East, but how much was this nation-building failure a failure of the West after the West carved up the Middle East following World War I?
There is a widely held view that, you know, that really is the core of the problem here in the Middle East, these artificial borders that were constructed by the British and the French that led to a series of artificial states and failed projects of nation building. That's a thesis that I think is widely believed in the broader population among journalists, but among social scientists and experts of the region, that thesis is actually widely discredited. The problem, in a nutshell, is not really where the borders were drawn, but what was happening within those borders by corrupt ruling elites during the post-colonial era, who basically presided over failed development projects, both economic and political. That's really where I think the story is. So, for example, today, despite the destruction and the decay of, let's say, both Syria and Iraq, I would argue that the vast majority of Iraqis and the vast majority of Syrians today still believe in the concept of a Syria and Iraq, still want that country to stay together. They may disagree on internal administrative boundaries, perhaps giving more autonomy to different parts, but as a nation state, I think that still is the primary loyalty of vast numbers of people throughout the region. And that's not difficult to fathom because, you know, several generations of people were born and bred and raised on these new nation states, notwithstanding the corrupt sort of authoritarian rule that they were living under. But I think that concept really does have much deeper roots than most people appreciate.
I wonder if we have both Sunni and Shiite listeners in the audience right now, some of whom might want to call in and talk about what that distinction means to you. How important is it to you as a Muslim, if you're a Sunni Muslim or a Shiite Muslim, and if you have roots in the Middle East or ties to the Middle East, how and how much and why to that degree do you think it plays out in intensely political and even violently political terms at times and in some places? Sunnis and Shiites, our phones are open for you for about the next 10 minutes. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Nadir Hashemi and Danny Postel, who are editors of a new book, Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East, 212-433-9692. And the book argues that sectarian identity of any kind is mostly a constructed identity in most places in the world, for most groups in the world, that really flows from social and political conditions. And at least one of your contributing authors says it's a myth that an ancient divide over succession after the Prophet Muhammad would have relevance today. How much do you believe that?
Well, we're not denying that sectarian identities exist and are real in the religious realm. The question that we really pose in the book is why now are these religious differences driving political mobilization, political identity, and why are they being lethalized in the region? This is a recent phenomenon. It is not the case that the politics of the region have always been defined by religious differences. The religious differences in and of themselves go back many centuries, but they haven't necessitated deep political divides. People haven't necessarily organized political parties or projects around their religious identities until very recently, and it has accelerated to a dramatic degree, particularly, as we say in the introduction of the book, since 1979, the key years that we focus on as the kind of turning points for the deepening sectarianization of the politics of the Middle East are 1979 with the Iranian Revolution and the Saudi counter-revolutionary response to the events in 1979.
Iran, and then you have, Iran Shiite, the Saudis Sunni.
Correct. And then you have in 2003, with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, you have a major political earthquake that I think we're all familiar with. And then in 2011, you have, with the Arab Spring, a series of events that didn't – the Arab uprisings themselves had nothing to do with sectarianism, but they were very quickly, unfortunately in our view, sectarianized mostly from above by regimes that were – terrified of social protest and popular forces making demands on the state. And what they did in many cases, and we document this in the book, in case after case, you have authoritarian regimes responding to cross-sectarian popular democratic uprisings whose slogans had nothing to do with religion or sectarianism, but these regimes constructed them as if they were. In the case of Syria, let's say, the Assad regime immediately responded that this is a Sunni, Salafi, jihadi plot against the so-called secular Syrian state. Or in the case of Bahrain, you had the Bahraini royal family and their Saudi patrons claiming that the popular uprising was an Iranian plot to spread Shiism throughout the region. These were false narratives that were forms of manipulation and distraction from the real issues, but these sectarian narratives took hold, and that this is the sectarianization process that we try to map in the book.
Mole in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Brian. I'm Syrian. I'm Sunni. It's 1973 when the president, Hafez al-Assad, the father, came to power. He actually killed and pushed away all the Sunni officers in the army, and he had only the army by Alawis and Christian supporters. That's the only thing. And this is the president who actually pushed all the sectarian. My family were part of the government at that time, and they had to run away and went to Dubai. And we lived in Dubai all my life. I'm born and raised there because of that. I could not see my country because of the sectarian happening.
Wow.
It's happened in 1973, and it's...
Why?
And it's
why would he want to push out a group like that?
Because he wanted to have the power for himself, for his family. He enriched his family, he enriched himself, and enrich his the tribe, because they have the tribe mentality. It's the sectarian tribe mentality. It's an only Alawi. And now Iran is supporting them because Iran is part Shia and the Alawi is part Shia, so they are supporting each other. And that's the whole thing is sectarian.
Mole, thank you so much. Wow, that's some story. So do either of you want to react to that and maybe tell us how much you see the Syrian civil war today with so many factions, as we know, in these terms?
Well, I would just jump in and comment on what the caller just said. I think he's right in the earlier part of his comments with respect to the problem in Syria and sectarianism being about political power and Assad trying to accumulate political power and manipulating sectarian identities as a way of doing that. In fact, that's many ways the exact thesis of the book, that it's political authoritarianism, not theology, that explains the rise of sectarianism. I think he's wrong in the second part of his analysis when he says that the reason why Iran is supporting Bashar al-Assad is because of a common theological Shia identity. That has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's all about Iran's perceived strategic vision for the region and how it views Bashar al-Assad as a key regional ally and access to Hezbollah, and it fears that if Bashar al-Assad is toppled, then a pro-Sunni or pro-Saudi regime will come in its place. I mean, that's fundamentally, I think, what's driving Iran's strong support for Bashar al-Assad and his war crimes in Syria.
Naji in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Naji.
Hi, Brian. My name is Magdi, and I have a question for your guest.
in the beginning, there was a Shiite and Sunni. Now we have Shiite, and the Sunnis have two schools of thought. One of them is the Wahhabism from Saudi Arabia, and the second part is led by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood ideology that started at the same time back in the beginning of the 20th century by the by their founding father, and then spread all over the Middle East. In Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood took over, the Saudis were fighting their perspective, which is a little bit more open than the interpretation of the Wahhabism, and they failed in Egypt. But they didn't fail, in Turkey. And their interpretation, the power, the struggle for the power between the two schools now is the Saudi Arabian controlling that action that's going on in Syria and Iraq and the Gulf and Yemen and, mm-hmm. and Libya. But the Turkish government kind of failed in the Middle East. So they are now looking over. Do you think they have now an influence in the European Muslims, where those European Muslims and the American Muslims have that more open-minded than the Wahhabism, or do you think it's the same interpretation from your opinion?
Wow. Who wants to answer that question?
Nader, you go ahead.
Well, I think the caller is pointing to an important, I think, factor in the rise of not just sectarianism, but also radicalism, and that is the spread of a particular puritanical and intolerant interpretation of Islam that is deeply, you know, sectarian in nature. And that comes out of the House of Saud and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, that because of the marriage of that particular Wahhabi school of thought and Saudi oil, that interpretation of Islam has gone global, affecting minority Muslim communities throughout the world. So that is a part of the story, not just in terms of the destabilization of the Middle East, but also in terms of the those Muslim minority communities in Europe and North America that the caller referenced. That is a big part. I would argue, had Saudi Wahhabi Islam not gone global due to a heavy investment in Saudi oil, we would not be seeing the same level of sectarian conflict and the other variant, deeper radicalization of some disgruntled, alienated Muslim youth who are attracted to militant ideologies and engage in these acts of terrorism that we've seen in recent years.
So in our last 2 minutes or so, you've written this, you know, really deep, complex book of multifaceted history with contributing editors from many, many points of view on how we got to the point that we're at today, especially with respect to Shiites and Sunnis in the Middle East. Can you draw any lessons from understanding sectarian history as you do for the fight to weaken these terrorist, nihilist ideologies that claim to be about pure Islam, like I think you're just describing, that, you know, almost everybody, most Muslims and most non-Muslims, want to fight? Or can you not draw anything so practical from that? Is that a political conversation for another set of guests?
Well, I can just say a word about that. Nader might have something else to add. But the final chapter of our book, Brian, is on the desectarianization process, or the possibilities of desectarianizing, countering the sectarianization of the Middle East today. And our contributor in that chapter is Timothy Sisk, who's not a Middle East specialist, but a comparative political scientist who draws lessons from other cases.
And we have 20 seconds, so to the point.
I think it's a tall order because it's a lot easier to sectarianize than to desectarianize. It might be tricky to get the sectarian genie back in the bottle, but it's not impossible.
Nader Hashemi and Danny Postel are the editors of Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.